The second main reform that the Crown introduced in the summer of 1642 was to reduce the payments to the officers. It reduced the gage, that is to say the salaries of the officers, to a half of their face value and ultimately later to a quarter of their face value, so that the venal office holder was now getting 5% and ultimately only a 2.5% return on his investment in the system. This was, in other words, in effect, more or less the same strategy that had been used in 1634. On the one hand, reduce the power of the officers by sending in the intendants to take over more and more of their functions, and second of all, to attack the investment which the office holders had made in the government itself. And having now done this on an even grander scale in 1642 than had been the case in 1634, what the Crown found is that cooperation with tax collection by the venal office holders, which was already tenuous up to this point, given all the affronts that they'd suffered, now collapsed almost completely. And the intendants were simply unable to fill all of the gaps. There just weren't enough of them to make up for the shortfall. In the year 1643, some of the districts in France sent something like 10% of the taxes they were supposed to send to the crown. Some of them only sent 1%, and indeed some of them just simply didn't pay any taxes whatsoever. Now, since the Thirty Years' War was ongoing at this time, since the crown was still heavily committed to war with Spain and war with Austria, the financial crisis continued. And therefore, in the winter of 1647-48, the crown announced yet another double attack on the investments of the officers. The crown authorized still further reductions, if that even seems possible, in the gage, that is to say, the salary payments of the venal officers. And the crown did something else which was much more radical. It authorized the absolute abolition of the polette, that institution which had allowed venal offices to be heritable. Now, to reduce the gage, the salary payment, or to reduce the payment on government bonds, the so-called rentes, these were old tricks. They had already been used in 1634, in 1642, and probably before that as well. What these old tricks did was more or less reduce, if you want to think of it this way, the yield of the officers' investment in the machinery of the state. But they didn't seriously damage the value of the principal itself, the capital that had been invested in the absolute estate. But to abolish the polette, by contrast, was something much more radical. It would have reduced the value of the officers' invested capital. It was going after the principal that had been invested in the machinery of the state, and this therefore provoked much, much more intense protest, spearheaded in particular by the Parlement of Paris, which mounted a ferocious protest against this proposal to abolish the polette. On the 13th of May, 1648, the main royal courts in Paris, at the instigation of the Parlement of Paris, formed a kind of union of their own, the so-called Chambre Saint-Louis. And this unified set of royal courts then mounted a frontal attack on the entire apparatus of war finance. The courts demanded not only guarantees of the future security of venal offices, but also a reduction in taxes, the right of the courts to audit royal accounts, the absolute abolition of the intendants, and ultimately the requirement that all new offices and all new taxes would now have to be approved by the courts. This comes very close, if you want to think of it this way, to the same demands made of Charles I of England by the Long Parliament in 1641 and 1642. Again, to go back to the English analogy, the crown decided to opt for force in the face of this resistance. And on the 26th of August, 1648, the crown arrested all of the leaders of the resistance of the Parlement, that is to say, the law court. This was a real mistake, because the Parlement's opposition to the fiscal policies of the crown had made it very popular with the Parisian people. There's a certain irony in this, insofar as officialdom depended upon royal taxes paid by the people for its very existence. But nonetheless, from a political point of view, the Parlement's opposition was very popular. And overnight, something like 1,200 barricades were erected in the streets of Paris. And this actually is sort of an interesting feature of early modern French history, that when the common people in the cities, especially in Paris, get angry, they tend to crowd into the streets, rip up the paving stones, and block the streets so the royal forces can't get through. This actually would continue to be a feature of popular protest in France right into the late 19th century. And there's a certain irony in that all of those beautiful wide avenues, which you now see in Paris today, were deliberately constructed in the aftermath of the Franco-Prussian War in 1870-71, which had seen another rising in Paris, to make the streets so wide that the people couldn't block them anymore. They are, in a sense, an architectural instantiation of the power of the state to block popular protest. But let's get back to the 17th century. Once the barricades were erected, the crowds then manned them all. And when the regent sent the chancellor, his own chancellor, to the Parlement the next day, angry crowds surrounded the Chancellor's carriage. They forced him to abandon it. They forced him actually to hide in a nearby house, which, and while they were ransacking the neighboring buildings looking for him, the terrified Chancellor in the end had to be rescued by a detachment of royal cavalry. The magistrates of the Parlement now set out as a body to meet the regent at the Louvre, the royal palace, followed by a huge crowd, which was estimated by contemporary observers to number as many as 20,000 people.